songs about that time. Right about now.
Right about now. Right about, right about, right about now.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Right About Now. I'm your host, Jonathan Small. Let me ask you something. What would you do if a drunk driver killed your husband and daughter? That nightmare scenario happened to my guest today, Jennifer Tracy, when her family's car was hit by a drunk driver. But rather than wallow in self-pity and anger, Jennifer transformed those emotions into something quite extraordinary. Compassion and forgiveness. Compassion and forgiveness for the man that killed members of her family.
The reality was this, Jonathan. He was going to get out at some point. So for me to not play a part, for me to be silent and not use my voice, for me to not advocate, for me to wish hate and anger, for me to even be happy that his life is miserable in there, is only adding to a less safe community that I live in.
My story on Jennifer is currently in the July issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. And she very generously agreed to come on the show to tell her story in more detail for my podcast listeners. Jennifer is a motivational speaker in Colorado and the author of Inside the Mind of Suicide. So Jennifer Tracy, welcome to Right About Now.
Hi.
It is so good to talk to you again.
You too.
I feel like we've gotten to know each other pretty well through this whole process.
I agree with you. It's a unique bonding experience.
It is always hard to ask somebody to let you into their very, very private life in such a personal way, in such a public way, because I knew that anything you said to me, unless you told me that it couldn't be in the story, would be in the story out there in the world, or could be. Do you remember the first time I called you to inquire about whether you would be interested in doing a story in Good Housekeeping?
I do. I was in my kitchen and pretty close to my table and had my laptop sitting there, and I really thought you were joking and that you were just kind of a scam and didn't believe that you seriously wanted to write an article.
Your story had been on some newscasts, and that's sort of how I found it, just through a big Google search. But had you had people reach out to you prior to me to talk to you?
Not in that way. Definitely not on a national level, not for a magazine. Definitely here in Colorado local, there's, you know, people who caught wind of his parole hearing and forgiveness and me advocating and people just wanting to understand that.
So once you realized that I was legit, was there any hesitancy about sharing your story with me?
No. No, I've always felt like being transparent about this can help other people who are in multiple stages of what I went through, not just with the DUI crash, but losing loved ones, even our first responders, you know, they're kind of on the flip side of it. And so I just felt like this story might be able to help someone. Like, even if a first responder reads this, I hope that they read it and they're like, wow, my job makes a difference.
I hope so too. And you just received the story. It was mailed to you. I have not even seen the story yet, so I'm a little bit jealous. but but you have it in front of you. And what's been the experience of just opening up a magazine and seeing your picture and pictures of your family there?
It's surreal. Like, I still hold the magazine in my hand, and I touch the cover of it, and I've, you know, read the whole magazine, because it's, you know, it's something I would read if I was sitting at the doctor's office or whatever. Anyway, like, it's definitely an appealing magazine. Yeah, to come up to a page that's got a big picture of me and my favorite picture of Brian and Brittany, it just makes me feel so honored that people get to see them and be a part of our story.
Now, the story has only been out about a week, maybe 10 days. It is in the July issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. But you've already said you have received some people reaching out to you about it.
Yeah, I did. I've had people through my website just submit a contact, you know, which is basically a submission, contact submission form, and just wanting more info. This, you know, like, the story, it's so hard. You did such a wonderful job really kind of compiling that all together, but I can definitely see how someone could read this and go, okay, there's got to be more here. Like, how do I find out the answer to these questions, you know?
And you even told me some people were wondering about your faith.
Yeah, that's been actually a big question that people have kind of posed to me, which is like, where are you now with that? And like, how did you get to forgiveness, and why? What, you know, propelled you on such a soul level to do that? And so it's neat, because as far as my faith goes, it's still strong. I think I've had to really think about the way that you wrote this in here. I love it. Where you say, I'm a self-described prayer warrior, and I recalled saying a prayer before they drove off, Father, keep them safe. And now I stopped going to church and praying because I thought, why pray when the answer's so horrific? And I think any human being can relate to that question, which is, we all have our different beliefs, you know? But in moments where there's nothing to grasp onto, we try to grasp onto that higher power or that heaven or that belief system. And tragedy has a way of really testing that. Right. And so, yeah, I feel like I'm a different person now.
Well, let's talk about that day and what happened. For those who haven't read the article, and I recommend that you read it, not because I wrote it, but because it's a beautiful story, a tragic story, and yet a story of forgiveness. And you amaze me, Jennifer, just what you've gone through and how you've dealt with it. It's just, it's amazing.
Thank you.
So if you wouldn't mind going back to a sad day, August 11th, 2004.
It was just a normal day, and, you know, we'd been at the school early in the morning registering the girls for school. We had just moved back from Iowa, and so we had actually looked in an apartment. Our U-Haul was still packed. We had several family members, you know, that we were staying with and visiting, and yeah, we were going to go get some school supplies, and at that last minute, I just decided not to go, and just had other things to do, decided not to go. And I know, as far as time's concerned, it was a pivotal moment in our story. Literally got to hug and kiss Miss Brittany Ann, and I actually kissed Brian on the forehead, and they drove off.
Now, Brittany was 9 years old.
Correct.
She's a twin with Michaela, your other daughter, who was 9 at the time. And Amber was 5. And your husband, Brian, were all in the car. Tell me a little bit about Brittany. She had cerebral palsy, but you said you've never seen like a spirit quite like that in your life.
Yeah, there is something about kids with special needs, and not all of them have it because, you know, if they're really, really locked up within themselves, they can be really angry and just so frustrated, and I get that. But Miss Brittany, cerebral palsy is where there's a lack of oxygen to the brain, and so her brain did not fire off messages like our brain does to the muscles. And so her tongue and her hands and her arms and stuff, they didn't work like yours and ours just do it automatically. So she was, you know, did a lot of therapy. She used a walker up until the time that she was 6 years old. And I remember when she was like 3 or 4, she had speech therapy, and as a way to like move the muscles of her tongue, you would put a starburst in the left side of her cheek. And she would basically, you know, as an incentive to like eat and chew this starburst, she had to try to move her tongue over there. I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of hours that we spent down at Children's Hospital, therapist at our house. I remember an incident where she was just learning to come up and down the stairs, and she sat at the top of the stairs crying, "Mommy, please come get me. Mommy, please come get me." And it was all that I could do to stay down at the bottom of those stairs on the side of the wall where she couldn't see me. And I was like, "Brittany Ann, we just practiced this, and I know that you can make it down these stairs." You know, anybody that has had a child with special needs, wow, they teach you so many lessons. She would fall down and get right back up and just look at you and smile, even though it hurt her, and just keep right on going.
She sounds like a wonderful, wonderful kid.
She was. I say was, you say is, and it's interesting. I actually had someone recently that had no idea anything about me or my story or whatever, and they're just like, "Do you have any kids?" And I was like, "Yeah, I do. I have 3 kids." So sometimes I go to the, I have 2 here and 1 there, or,
right,
you know, it's an interesting answer.
Well, she's with you, but in a different way, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. So you decide not to go with them. Brittany says to you, what does she say to you right before they pull away?
She says to me, "One more hug, Mom. One more kiss."
And they drive off. What happens next is just absolutely everybody's worst nightmare. It's a horrible, horrible accident. They're driving down the highway, and a few miles away, a gentleman by the name of Vladimir Gunin, a 57-year-old Russian emigre, is driving his pickup truck, and he has a blood alcohol level of 0.209. They are going down the highway one way, and he is driving into the busy highway inebriated. He has another passenger in his car. He doesn't stop at the stop sign, and he strikes the vehicle that your family is in. Brian and Brittany were killed upon impact. Amber and Michaela were seriously injured and had to be transported by helicopter, right, from the scene to a hospital.
Yeah, Miss Amber went by ambulance. Michaela was airlifted.
And this was before cell phones were widely used. This was in 2004. And you had no idea for hours that this had happened.
Yeah. Yeah, it truly is one of those things that it is a parent's every worst nightmare. I mean, all of it. I think on one hand, you know, you think about losing everybody. And the element of my two girls surviving that crash is probably the key pivotal moment of me actually being alive, even talking to you today, John. I've replayed in my mind over and over and over so many different things from that day and that moment and that prayer and that intersection and my belief system and family members and what other people were doing. And I am pretty certain that I would not be here right now speaking to you if I had lost all of them that day.
You found out in a horrible way, an officer just showed up at your door, right? An officer and the coroner, I believe you said, which I found very unusual, showed up your mother's door. They had tracked you down through just their research of where you might be, because you didn't have a home at that time. You had just moved back from Iowa. You didn't even have an apartment yet. Like you said, your stuff was in a U-Haul. You were staying with your mom.
Yeah, my mom was listed at Children's Hospital as an emergency contact. And then they pulled a last name off of Brian's driver's license. And so they did kind of a search. And it's so crazy. But when they actually knocked on my mom's door, they weren't even certain that they had found the right place, you know, of anybody who knew these kids. So they, we're still investigating at that point, as in, like, are you the mother of Brittany Bryan, you know, of Brittany, Michaela, and Amber? It's like, yeah.
And they told you what had happened.
Yeah. Yeah. They said, ma'am, I'm really sorry to tell you. And at the time they actually said to me, your youngest daughter is dead and your two other children are down at Children's Hospital fighting for their lives. It was an interesting time because I remember being in my mom's kitchen and she had a tile floor, and I just remember falling to the ground in her kitchen and, I mean, just wailing and screaming hysterically and just like screaming out to God, like, please help me. And yet there was this like other maternal thing going on. Like, I need to get down to the hospital. And I remember the officer. So my stepdad, David, was there, my mom, and they stayed with me. It had to have been an hour that we had to work through some stuff, and they wanted to make sure that David was actually okay, just emotionally, to drive my mother and I safely down to Children's.
And they drove you down there. Is this vivid in your memory, or is it just one of these things that you're in so much shock at this moment that you don't remember a lot of it?
Oh no, it's so vivid. It's like, I can't believe that I'm coming up on 14 years, because it's that crisp of a memory.
Right. So the officer did not mention that Brian had passed away either. He just said that your daughter had passed.
No, they did. They said, okay, your husband and your youngest child are dead.
Okay.
Yeah. It was kind of an interesting twist in our story, because Brittany was so little from the cerebral palsy that they just assumed that she was the youngest.
Right.
But she wasn't the youngest.
No. So when you got to the hospital, it was a chaotic scene.
It was chaotic for me. You know, intensive care units, if you've ever been to one, they do a pretty good job of controlled atmosphere. You know, you walk into something you've never seen before unless you've been there, but they were all pretty calm and did a really good job of keeping me okay.
Yeah.
But like I said, just those, the things, the parts of the story were like, they'd been looking for us for hours. And so they actually had them, you know, child A and child B, like they didn't even know their names.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, there were just so many different parts of the story that made it worse, you know?
Yeah. So it just said like child A on their sheet by their bed. Wow.
And it still does. Like if you read that record from that moment in the ICU, it's still child A and child B. Hmm.
So what did you see? Was each girl in a different room?
They were, yeah.
And what do you recall seeing? What had happened?
Well, so what was crazy is the first room I walked into was Amber, who they had told me my youngest had passed away. And so I just remember like freaking out because I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Am I seeing things here? Am I going crazy? But like I swear to God, this looks like Amber. And so then I do remember, I don't want to say I wasn't nice, but I just went from like being okay and need to like see my kids or what's going on to this like, okay, who the hell is in the next room? Like I've been preparing myself for almost 2 hours to see my twins. And now all of a sudden it's like, I don't even know who survived, you know? So I'm like, okay, this is Amber. So who's the other one that survived? And it was, again, it's like such a weird twist, right?
Yeah. Like, so Amber was your 5-year-old. Amber was your youngest, and they had told you that your youngest had passed away. And so you were in the car going over there. You had mentally told yourself that that was what was happening. And then the reality was very different when you got to the hospital.
Yeah. I mean, I had been preparing myself for the fact that she was gone and my twins were alive. And again, there's just not even a word in our English language to explain, like, you're not elated or happy that one is alive and the other one isn't. I mean, there's just not even a word.
Right. So the girls had severe injuries. Thankfully, they survived, Michaela and Amber. Michaela was left with partial hearing loss. She had facial paralysis. Amber's injuries were more internal, aside from some of the physical injuries. She has obviously gone through a lot of trauma, and she remembers a lot of what had happened. So how long did it take them to recover?
Their recovery was very different. So Amber came out of kind of her unconsciousness within days. And again, her injuries externally really did not look that bad. Whereas, you know, you took one look at Michaela and she's got a probe going into her head where they're relieving pressure off of her brain. And she's, you know, hooked up to everything you can. I mean, she was on full life support. So I did. I literally had to excuse myself multiple times and go to the bathroom and just throw up. And they had a waiting area. And like, there were times that I wished that people like weren't in there because I just wanted to go in there and scream and freak out. But there wasn't really anywhere to do that.
Right. And the children did recover. Like you said, they were in different time. Thankfully, they both recovered. But you kind of went into mothering mode at this point. I remember you told me, like, the sort of hyper maternal part of you kicked in to make sure that they were going to be okay.
Yeah, it's interesting how I went into that mode. And I went into that mode, Jonathan, for really several years. Like, my focus truly was like, somehow, because I had done some previous work, you know, mostly around mental health and grief and trauma and loss, it was like Brian and Brittany are not coming back. Like they're gone. And I just poured every bit of energy that I had into fighting for their lives. And Michaela had this like CD case. It was one. Do you remember when you would have the little round CD plate?
Yep.
And then you'd have like the little fold thing.
Yeah. Like you like put them in a book, like a binder. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a small little CD book. And she had had that. And so in there, you know, some of her favorite music was some Christian music, Amy Grant and Avalon, which is probably a group that like most people don't even know of. But they did, while she was in that induced coma, you know, I played music that was in her little CD case. I mean, it was so much family was there. And, you know, we would all go in and take turns and let them know we were there. And
so you did this for years, but you were obviously hurting inside. You quit your job as a hairstylist. I think you mentioned to me that you were cleaning apartments at one point to make ends meet.
Yeah. So the apartment complex, actually, that Brian and I had picked out, that apartment, I ended up moving in to that place. And just as a way to kind of fit the pieces together of everything that was going on in our lives, I just cleaned the apartments as people moved out. And, you know, I was left without a house or a car or any life insurance money. There was absolutely nothing tangible for me at that moment. And I'm telling you, that community rallied beside me. Catholic Charities paid my rent for 8 months. I had a friend from church give me a car. My stepdad and my dad both forked over money every single month to make ends meet.
That's wonderful that people stepped up.
They did.
So I want to talk about Mr. Goonan. And I should mention that we tried to get in touch with him for the story and we're not successful. So, and I imagine you have not heard from him since the story came out.
I haven't. And, you know, that's definitely something that I want to investigate just a little bit further, because we really did have a connection.
So you went to his trial.
I did.
When you first saw him, what did you think?
You know, it's sad to say this, but it's just a true reality. But I come from a family history of alcoholism, and he actually looked like my mom's dad.
Who I imagine was an alcoholic.
Who was an alcoholic who died, you know, I think in his 50s from liver. What is that called? Failure or whatever, when you just drink so much that your liver
just conks out. Work. Yeah.
And that is kind of, I think, something that I would love to talk further with you about. And I don't know if we'll do that today or
we can.
Or if it's just, you know, or if it's just even something that I just really want to talk about. But, you know, I read this story and it's like there's this huge why, you know, like, why would I do this? Why would I advocate for Goonan?
Right. So just to backtrack, in case people haven't read the story, Goonan was sentenced to 24 years in prison. But even in the trial, you forgave him. Tell us about that.
Well, and I think that that's the interesting piece for me, was that, like, I had already had experience with people who struggled with drinking and alcoholism. And so for me to look at this man who killed Brian and Brittany, who killed my loved ones, and to see that he was remorseful, like, it was so interesting, because the judge, as the victim of this, and there were several of my family members that were there, and there were some that wanted him to have the death sentence and some that wanted him to have life. Like, I kind of stood in my own space with how I was in that courtroom, but I I told the judge that I felt he should get the maximum sentence, but that he should be given every chance at rehabilitation. And that really is a motto, I guess, in this world that you and I live in, that I live by, which is even my own kids don't escape from me, which is, you know, they can go out and make a poor choice today. And in their anger, if they do something as horrific, I'm not going to go in and ask the judge to lower their sentence because, you know, they had bad things happen to them when they were young. Like, I wouldn't ask a judge to remove the consequences of what they did. But I have told both of my girls, you can be assured of this. My love for you will not change.
Hmm.
I will be there. I would send you cookies. I will come visit you. I would fight for you. And that's kind of what I was getting at earlier when I said I really want to talk about this, is that was my why, Jonathan. It was love your neighbor as you love yourself. If Gunan had been my father and had killed two people, I would want him to serve time, but I would want him to be given every chance at rehabilitation. If Gunan had been my daughter who killed two people, I would want her to suffer her consequences, but be given every chance at rehabilitation. And if that had been me, that is what I would have wanted. And it really wasn't until last year that I really started reflecting on, why are you advocating so much for this man, Jennifer? And it was just that concept of, like, you know what? I can't play a part in all of those other prisoners. I can't. Like, I can't just walk up and say, can you tell me about inmate 224? Oh, well, what did he do? Oh, well, let me see if I can advocate for him. Like, I don't get to do that. But this person was in my life, and I had a choice to make. And that was the choice that I chose to make. Does that make sense?
It makes sense intellectually. In a beautiful way, it makes sense. And yet, so many people wouldn't have made that choice. They would have just chosen to hate him.
Yeah.
And give him the worst punishment. But it seems like you're just not, that's just not the way that you think or believe or feel. You forgave him. And also, at the same time, it was a tough love. You wanted him to serve his sentence, but you also wanted him to get help. And
right.
He didn't really get help, which then you mentioned that you became a bit of an advocate for him. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I didn't realize, I mean, it's an interesting thing, right? Because as the victim, to be very clear in my statement to the judge, which is, you know, I do think you should give him the maximum sentence, but asking that he be given every chance at rehabilitation, and then to go to his first parole hearing, which is 11 years, and to find out that he really had not had any therapy, it is so strange, but as the victim, I felt like re-victimized.
Hmm.
I felt like the thing that I had asked for as the victim, the system failed me. And I feel like the system fails people all the time, because those people eventually re-enter back into our society. And if we don't teach them and empower them to look at themselves and how to make changes, then you and I, we're all playing a part of this big dysfunctional system where we just hate people who make bad choices. And you and I both know that we make bad choices all the time. Sometimes you and I make choices and we just don't get caught. And and sometimes, right? And then there's some people who clearly make choices that you and I wouldn't even dream of doing. So I'm not trying to throw us all into one category, but yeah, it made me angry. And you did a great job in the story. I really,
well, I thank you. I mean, all I had to do basically, as anybody can hear, was just roll tape. I mean, it's you who makes this story amazing. And, you know, one of the opportunities that you gave me, which was very generous of you, is you allowed me to sit in one of his parole hearings. We went to downtown Denver and were escorted into this small office with a small TV monitor. And I guess it wasn't a judge, but there was a woman there in attendance who worked for the state. And she was to hear his parole request. And I had to leave my cell phone and any recording devices outside of the room. All I could do was scribble in a notebook.
Yeah, they were pretty clear about that, weren't they?
They were pretty clear about that, although then they ended up giving me a recording of the proceedings. So I guess it is public. So I will never forget that, because I was sitting next to you and he suddenly appears in his prison jumpsuit, sitting in a conference room by a metal table, and he's being piped in through video, and suddenly there's this man there and he can barely look at the camera. Do you remember his body language?
Oh, very much.
Yeah. He was like slouched in his chair. And this was probably, you know, this is
12 years in, I think.
12 years into his sentence.
Yeah. The one that you came to was about 12 years in. And, you know, you and I didn't really get to talk about it, but I think that first parole hearing, he saw a woman that forgave him. And I think he thought his chances of things getting better for himself in there, maybe giving therapy, maybe getting out. I think he was really hopeful in that first parole hearing. And then that whole year went by and I don't think things got better for him. And so by the time you got there, I think you saw a man that just was like, he just felt so defeated in that system.
And meanwhile, you're advocating for him. You're advocating for to get more help. And he didn't seem to be able to admit that he might have an alcohol problem, which was disturbing to me.
Yeah, me too. And I could not tell if it was a Russian issue, like if
a cultural, yeah,
a cultural thing, or if he just wasn't understanding the question, or if he truly did not think he had a drinking problem. But I do remember him. I don't know if you remember or not, but I remember him tying it all up at the very end of that hearing and basically saying, look, I get that the rules here are different than where I came from, and I know the rules, and I will never drink and drive again. Like, do you remember him kind of summing that all back up? It was like, I get the rules. I get them. And so, you know, whether he thinks he's an alcoholic or not, whether he drinks now while he's at home or not, that's not the bigger question, because we all know people drink, right? The bigger thing is like having the self-control to either make a responsible and get a responsible way home, or to not drink and drive. Like, I felt like he was saying, I get it. And then, and this is the reality of it too. And I think sometimes people don't think about this, but the reality was this, Jonathan, he was going to get out at some point.
Right.
So for me to not play a part, for me to be silent and not use my voice, for me to not advocate, for me to wish hate and anger, for me to even be happy that his life is miserable in there, is only adding to a less safe community that I live in. If that man gets out, which he would at some point, whether I played a part in it or not, like, he had a parole date. And the system is full of people. And so if people are there on good behavior and they do this and then they do that, like, he was going to get out.
Right.
And so, again, that's just another part of me being logical and saying, okay, well, if he is going to get out, wouldn't it be better for our community if he actually looked at himself and said, I need to make some changes, and when I get out, I'm going to be a different person?
For sure. And I think just your love and compassion was such a lesson for him. I mean, he was just so blown away by it. He thanked you in the session that I went to. He thanked you and apologized to you again. And it felt sincere, even though there was a language barrier. I think it's one of the few things he said in English.
Yep.
I am sorry, you know, thank you. And looked up at the camera. It was very powerful.
I gave you a copy of the letter that he wrote me, right?
You did.
When, you know, he had sent it to Chris Vanderveen, which was Nine News out here. And then Chris reached out to me and said, hey, I want to be, you know, completely respectful. Vladimir sent me a letter that he wanted me to give to you. Do you want this? And so I said, yeah. And the gist of his letter was, I don't know how you can forgive me because I can't forgive myself, but what a gift it is that you have given me. And thank you. And getting that letter, that was the first year after the parole hearing, getting that letter confirmed again to me that this was a person who was remorseful for what they had done. And even though there was that language barrier, I did feel like he was someone that should be given the chance to make amends and do what he could, you know, with the rest of his life instead of be punished for the rest of his life.
So after that parole hearing, are you asked to sort of weigh in on whether you think that he should go free, or how does that work?
Yeah, so as the victim, the voice of the victim really holds a lot of weight in these procedures, or that's not the right word.
Proceedings.
I knew that wasn't the right word. And so, you know, I question that as well. I question, like, had I gone in and if I just kind of put my foot down and tough loved it and said, you know what, I'm just not okay with this yet. I think that he's done some therapy, but I don't think he should get out yet. You know, anything at all like that, it is very, very possible that there would have been a different outcome, because the voice of the victim weighs very heavily on those that make the decision on them getting out.
Mm-hmm. And you did not express that you wanted him to stay in prison?
No, it was probably one of the, like, moment of truth. Like, I'd been talking about, you know, well, if Mr. Goonan got paroled, you know, like, I'd been speaking about it for so many years. By that time, it was like my heart was racing, and I'm like sitting there going, oh my gosh, this moment is upon me, and I'm being asked what I think. And I actually had family members like just not want to be with me anymore because they felt like this man should burn in hell and never get out of prison. And so they don't talk to me anymore.
Hmm.
Yeah, I got a lot of backlash from doing what I did, which is so interesting because I told you my family history of alcoholism. And I'm like, that could have been someone in our family. Like, how can you not see that who I'm ultimately fighting for could have been someone we loved?
They couldn't see it, but you saw it so clearly.
Yeah, they still can't see it. Like, I still don't talk to that person. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. I didn't realize that. That's not in my story.
Yeah.
No. Well, there was a lot that couldn't be in my story.
Yes, there was. You did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always, you know, I think it's a 2,000 word story max, and it's a story that could be a book. And I've already tried to encourage you to write a book about it because you're a great writer. But let's talk about that in a minute. I want to just finish this portion of the story. To fast forward a little bit, Mr. Goonan was released earlier this year. We thought or you thought at one point, you thought that he might be going first to a halfway house and might have to wear an ankle bracelet that would monitor whether he had been drinking or not. But that's actually not what happened. He was released. He was it was determined by the state that he did not need drug or alcohol treatment, and he also hit the right to drive was also restored. So I called you when we found that out to get your reaction, and I was a little concerned when I called you because I knew that I would be the first person telling you that. But your reaction, as always, amazed me. You were not upset about it. And do you remember what you said and what you thought when I told you that?
Yeah, it took me a minute to kind of take it all in and really think about them releasing him. And there's some behind the scenes stuff that I'm sure goes on when they make those determinations. And I'm sure of it, some of it's, you know, financially and things like that. And so I tried to kind of wrap my head around the fact that, like, he wasn't in a halfway house and he was not driving with, you know, an airlock device or anything like that. And I just had a lot of peace because I felt like I had played my part and I played it up to the part that I could, and that he was a free man and it was up to him what he was going to do with that gift and how he's going to live the rest of his life. And I can't control that. I really do have a lot of peace in that. I would love to talk to him, though. I mean, if it was something that, you know, we could talk and he could tell me about his experiences in prison and he could actually hear my experiences as a grieving mom. And I would love to know that he's like, I took it to heart, Jennifer, and I work on a construction site. And you know what I mean? Like, just
to know that you made a difference.
Yeah, that I made a difference and that he's living his life and that I hope that he has some kind of happiness with his freedom. Like, I would hate to think that he's out and that he hates life.
Hmm.
That he's alone or he can't get a job or that.
See, it's amazing to me that that's where you go with it. Because I would think that you would think, well, I would hate to hear that he's out and he's at a bar getting drunk. You know, you go to a totally different place, I think, than most people where it's like you have so much compassion for him. It's amazing. You know, you understand what I'm saying, right? It's
just, oh, yeah. I hear you. I guess Yeah.
So I hope that you can meet because I know that means a lot to you. And it would probably mean a lot to him. You would need to have a translator there because I don't think his English is very good.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll happen. So if he did reach out to you, you would agree to see him?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. If he reached out and... Jonathan, I can't believe it's been a year. Like, we are literally coming up upon a whole year that his hearing.
That's true. That happened in July is when I flew out there.
Yeah.
So I don't want to dwell too much on Vladimir because there is a part of your story that really didn't make it into my story for Good Housekeeping just because of space considerations and because, like I said, it's a book, your whole story. But we touch on it a little bit, and that's kind of what you did with your life in terms of talking to other grieving people, talking to first responders, and you really have started a second career. You're an author of a book. So tell me a little bit about that part of your life.
You know, professionally, I spent most of my life as a hairstylist, and it's interesting because when you do a trade, you basically exchanged an amount of time and then you get to see something. So whether you build houses or fences or you cut hair, you know, someone spends an hour with you and you cut their hair. When they leave, they're either happy or they're not, right? But they pay you to cut their hair. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, it's tangible and it's measurable and you can kind of tell if you do a good job because somebody will come back and get their hair cut a second time if they like what you did, right? Well, as a speaker, you speak, I would speak to, you know, 1,500 students, hundreds of offenders.
So you were invited to explain this. You were invited at first to speak to a Mothers Against Drunk Driving meeting, right? To talk about your experience. Is that how this all started, that you started speaking publicly about this?
Yeah. So it was literally just like, just share your story with a group of officers at, it was called the Law Enforcement Recognition Event. It was a breakfast that they'd put on. And it was basically thanking the officers for what they did and reminding them the importance of their job and, you know, sharing our story. But it was the first time I ever shared my story. And it took me, you know, a while to get to that place. Just like you mentioned in this article, I did have to go through a period where it was like, okay, Brian and Brittany are gone. I can't change that. I've got Michaela and Amber and myself to focus on. And it was like, that is what I focused on. Eventually I got to a place where I could bring out their belongings and their pictures and be okay with, like, okay, they're gone, but they can still be a part of my life. But one thing, and I didn't even really get to tell you this, was part of the reason why I quit doing hair, because when you get your hair done, guess what everyone likes to talk about? Small talk. Are you married? Do you have kids? Are you Native? And so can you imagine working at a hair salon and let's say it takes you 20 minutes to cut someone's hair and they're like, oh yeah, so do you live around here? Do you have kids? Are you married? Which I didn't have a wedding ring on. And so, you know, no, I'm not married. Well, do you have any kids?
Right. You don't want to tell that story 20 times a day. And
you don't want to tell that story 20 times a day. And so then I went through like 2 week period where I tried really hard and I just said, yeah, I have two girls, Michaela and Amber. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I cannot do this. I cannot pretend that she doesn't exist just to spare the person whose hair I'm cutting. Like, it was a huge conflict in what I did for a living because I felt like there was no way to win in that situation. So speaking for that event and seeing how that story touched so many people's lives and it inspired them to be better at their jobs, it lit a fire in me. I just saw how my story could impact people. So as an author, of all the work I've done professionally, writing this book was the hardest thing I've done professionally.
So tell me about the book and what it's called.
It is called Inside the Mind of Suicide, From Deepest Darkness to the Light of Hope. And I take my readers through my 2 year struggle with suicide. And I decided right away when I wrote this book that I would do exactly what I did with my speaking, which was I would take my story and I would weave teaching nuggets in it. And so at the end of each chapter, there are pretty thought-provoking questions that really turns the story from about me into, you know, how does this apply to you? And can you see yourself in this story? And can you relate to this? And so far, I've just, what I feel like I did was I duplicated myself. Like, it is such an awesome feeling to know that someone is struggling. I had a friend recently and her daughter was struggling. And so she purchased a book and she sent it to her daughter. And she was like, Jennifer, I don't know if she'll read it or not. But her daughter did. And her daughter reached out to me and wrote me the most beautiful, heartfelt thing. And it's such a neat thing, Jonathan, to be like, I poured everything I had into that. It's like birthing a child. And now this lady that I don't even know gets to experience me, gets to experience my life's work and my wisdom and my teaching and all of that. And I don't even have to be in her home while she does that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so it is so rewarding. It is such a rewarding feeling.
And you just wrote a second book, you were telling me before we went on air.
Yeah, I'm working on a really, really short one. It's called Be Heard. And it's all about just honoring your own emotions and how to communicate that in an effective way. So it'll be a really, really short book, but I'm working on another one. It's called How the F Word Changed My Life.
The F Word?
The F Word. And it's a better understanding of forgiveness.
You got me there. Yeah. You tricked me.
I know. I love it. Like, that one is, that one's a little bit harder because it's like basically the how, like teaching you how to get to that level of forgiveness. And so that one's not quite as easy to write, but.
How do you write? What's your process?
Definitely brain dump. So hold nothing back. Just write it all out. Then I sit down and draw and outline the best that I can. So from the brain dump, it's like, oh, okay. I kind of, you know, look through that and say, okay, there's this topic here. Yep, this topic here. And then from that, what ends up happening is it just comes to me. And so once I have a chapter or I have a nugget that I know I want to teach, I can be driving down the interstate and like, it will just like 3,000 words will come to me. And so I'll stop and pull off the side of the road and I'll just start talking into my phone as best as I can. And then basically when I get back home, I'm like, oh yeah, that goes in chapter 7.
Do you find writing to be very therapeutic?
Very much. Yeah. Yep. So the hardest part at the end of my book was turning it over to an editor. And I found an awesome lady in Loveland who edited. And I absolutely love how she would make a comment and then she would say, tell me more or tell me why. So she never changed my voice. She asked just the right questions so that when you would read it. So for instance, like I would say something like, I had to have a complete hysterectomy when I was 24. And she would say things like, your reader may not understand what a complete hysterectomy is. So tell us what that is and why at 24 you had to have that. So she did a really, really good job of helping me give you more of what you needed to understand what I was trying to write. And then grammatically, you know,
yeah,
I
helping with that.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like she did a good job with that.
Yeah. It was interesting that note that she gave you about the hysterectomy. So it's often about details, right? Like you sometimes think, oh, I don't want to get too detailed, but sometimes the details are what make writing really come to life. You know, I know that a notes that I would sometimes get back, and it's hard with stories like yours, because if you didn't give me the details the first time around, then I, you know, luckily we had a nice relationship and I felt like I could call you and ask you, hey, can you tell me a little bit more about this? But sometimes I only have one chance to talk to somebody. So I try to get as much sort of as I can possibly get in the length of time that I have to do the interview, because I know that those are that kind of color is what makes a story just go from like just a bland story to being something a little bit more, to be able to touch, taste, feel, see what you're reading.
And I absolutely love how you ended this article, and I won't give it away for the reader.
Well, I often will save what I think is the most powerful thing until the end, and that was one of the most powerful stories that you told. And it's interesting because I interviewed somebody recently who said, I always put the most interesting thing in the beginning. And, you know, and I do too. I mean, I guess I try to do both. But yeah, I think sometimes people just throw away the end. And I try. And, you know, you gave me so much to work with that I had a lot of. I remember there was a few different ways that I had ended your story. But that was the one that thankfully that resonated the most. I'm glad that you liked it. And listen, I was really worried before you read that story, because as you can imagine, you know, it's my voice, not yours. You're used to writing in your own voice. You're sharing this incredibly personal story with me, and it's out there now in the world, according to me. So I it means so much to me that you like the story. So thank you for that. I just want to make sure I thank you for that. And, you know, obviously I just really feel like I was a vehicle for which you could tell your story. I don't really feel like I added too much to it, but I'll take it. Hey, us writers don't get a lot of, it's not like we're actors who get to get on stage and everybody applauds. You don't really hear too much feedback once it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so being a writer myself, I had to read the story as though I wasn't a writer.
Interesting.
And appreciate the way you wrote it. And just to even hear it in your voice was just a unique experience for me. It really was.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. If people want to get in touch with you and reach out to you, what's the best way that they can do that? Check out your website.
Yeah, you can get, I mean, you can learn so much on the website about what I do, who I am, what I'm up to currently. You can email me, phone number, all that's on there. So that's jennifertracy-inspire.com.
jennifertracy-inspire.com.
Yep. My book is available on Amazon. And if anybody wants a signed copy of a book, they can just reach out to me through the email, and I would be happy to send a book out to anyone personally signed. People ask me that all the time, and I'm still kind of shocked by that. They're like, will you send my book, please? And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. Sure, yeah.
That's awesome. And just so everybody knows, your two older daughters, you're not older daughters, but your two daughters, Amber and Michaela, are doing great. I think, tell us a little bit about what they're doing. Proud mom.
They are just living life. And that's kind of where I am too. And it's interesting, you know, I'm freshly into my 40s. I've got a 23-year-old and a 20-year-old. And we do life together. I mean, Miss Amber's in Alaska for the summer. Miss Michaela just took off on a 4-day camping trip with a bunch of friends from high school. Michaela already graduated from college. Amber's like, I'm not going to college until I absolutely know what I want to do. And it may be a trade. And so I may not go to college. I live in a fairly small town here in Colorado. And one of my favorite things is my boyfriend and I, we purchased a table that actually seats 12 people. So he has two girls and right exactly almost the same age. And I have two girls. And it is like one of our favorite things is to just cook a meal and everybody comes over and we've got a spot for everyone at the table. And that's one of my favorite things to do. One of my favorite things to cook is stroganoff.
That's wonderful to hear. Not that your favorite thing to cook is stroganoff, but that you guys like to gather around the table and just talk and...
We do.
That's great.
And that's why I'm saying the way that you ended that story or our story is really, it's something I have to work hard to remind myself, Jonathan, is that because I do carry an unrelenting sadness. I do. I miss Brittany so much. And there are just moments where I'm like, I'm done. It's over. I'm out of here. But then I look at those two other beautiful girls and I'm like, can't do that.
And you said to me that, you know, part of it that's always been hard for you is that Brittany had a twin. Michaela looks like Brittany.
She does.
So that can be hard, I can imagine. But in some ways, you also have her there in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bittersweet thing, yeah. You know?
Well, again, I am forever inspired by you, Jennifer, and I'm sure all my listeners will be too. You're quite a remarkable person, and what you've had to endure in a life is almost unimaginable, and yet you persevere. And I really look forward to reading all your new books, and thank you for doing the podcast.
Yes.
Look for the story in the July issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. Jennifer Tracy, thanks again.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, writeaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella, reminding you to
do the right thing.
Thanks, Ella.
You're welcome.